Okay, folks. Hi there. Alvin Shamroff here once again for our every two-week seminar. I have to start by giving profuse apologies for last week. I was traveling internationally and just was unable to make it without realizing that I was supposed to actually be doing a teleseminar while I was in the air. So my sincerest apologies. This is a very, very rare occurrence, and I certainly trust it won't happen again. With that out of the way, this is a makeup session for last week, and what I have is the two questions that we had presented to us that came in for last week, and they're actually very good questions, and the issues are very relevant to everyone listening in. So I'm going to just go through those, and we'll see how it goes along. I have a sneaking suspicion that the two people who submitted them are not with us today, but what I'm going to do, I'm going to unmute everyone just momentarily so that if I'm going to call out the name, first name, and if the candidate is listening in, please let me know, because then you can tell us in your own words about the case. So firstly, is William there? Is William signed in? I don't hear anything. What about Aaron? Is Aaron there? I don't hear Aaron. Okay, not the end of the world. I'm going to mute everyone again. And now I'm just going to read what I got in the email from these two cases, and then I'll go ahead and discuss them. So the first case was presented to me by William. And it's as follows. The diagnosis, AUB, due to uterine fibroid with failed medical management of the bleeding. No endometrial biopsy was done. He doesn't give the age, by the way, but that's of secondary importance. Endometriosis of pelvis diagnosed after surgery. The procedure was a robotic-assisted hysterectomy, bilateral self-injectomy, left oophorectomy, lysis of adhesions, also a cystoscopy, and an intraoperative consultation with general surgery due to dense uterine adhesions to the colon. The weight of the uterus is 302 grams. The uterus showed adenomyosis, benign intramural subserosal and submucosal fibroids. Cervix was normal. Tubes showed endometriosis. And the ovary showed a corpus luteum. So this is what was written down. Now, the main issue that William wanted to discuss was the fact that there was no endometrial biopsy. Now, it would be nice to have him to clarify a few things, but I want to discuss some other issues just based on the information that he's given. And You'll understand why I'm bringing up these issues, because I'm going to bring up the very issues that the examiner would likely bring up, because there are several question marks in the presentation, on paper at least, and they need clarification. So the first one, obviously, why was no endometrial biopsy done? And age plays a minor role in that discussion, keeping in mind she went for a hysterectomy. It's not watching AUB in the office. So that's number one. And I'll come back to that. Number two, endometriosis was diagnosed after surgery. I think that's a type. It must have been diagnosed during surgery, and the histology report came back post-op. So I think that's what he means. But is the endometriosis significant, or I should say clinically significant if there wasn't any pain. He talks only about AUB. Now, there's failed, he specifically mentions failed medical management. That's fine. But keep in mind, there's conservative, and this is very important for everyone listening in, there's also conservative surgical management that one can consider for such a patient before taking her to the operating room. And what I'm talking about here is maybe just a simple DNC and possibly a endometrial ablation, which depending on the size, at 300 grams, that's probably too big for an endometrial ablation. But it's certainly something that you want to discuss. If William really wanted to talk about ablation, I would advise him to write on paper, and the principle is what's important for all of you. If you want to talk about something that didn't happen, but you still want to talk about it, phrase it this way. Write down on paper, on the case list, even though an endometrial biopsy was not appropriate in this presumably large uterus, you can write down ablation not feasible. If you write down ablation not feasible, the examiner is almost obligated to ask you why not, and that's a ticket to get your conversation going on endometrial ablation. So again, you folks have heard me talk about reverse engineering. This is just a small, simple example of that. If you want to have a conversation of endometrial ablation, when you got a case like this or somewhat similar to this, put down words to the effect of ablation not feasible. And you'll get that conversation in all likelihood. So that's one other point. No mention of conservative surgical therapy. And folks, I want to just impress upon you, throughout your exam, but especially on the GYN side, you've got to show how you exhausted all conservative options of therapy before resorting to the OR. And in this case, he appropriately mentioned failed medical therapy. We'll assume it was somewhat comprehensive. But he doesn't mention anything about conservative surgical therapy, and that's what's missing here. The next thing is the robotic assist. Could this not have been done as a TVH at 300 grams? I don't think any of us would attempt it. But be prepared to discuss about the potential role for preoperative dapagliflozin and what's the effect of that. So if you, again, an example of reverse engineering, if you are comfortable and want to have a conversation on dapagliflozin, then write down dapagliflozin not a possibility. You want to phrase it in a negative, because by phrasing it in a negative, you're piquing the examiner's curiosity. So I'm just giving you the general principles. The specifics obviously will vary from case to case. But this could be a conversation point for dapagliflozin, even though it's probably not a realistic option. Also, the conversation becomes, and this holds for any of you who've got a robotic case on your case list, you've got to be able to describe why it needed to be done robotically and why conventional laparoscopy wouldn't have been sufficient. You've got to justify the robotic approach. And then in general terms, be able to discuss the pros and cons of a robotic versus a conventional laparoscopic approach. Then what else? The other big thing, which is a fairly favorite question in my opinion. When you're doing laparoscopic hysterectomy, be it with or without the robot, many of you are doing a concomitant cystoscopy just to make sure that you see urine coming down the ureters, through the ureteric orifices. And there have been a couple of committee opinions on this, and also a couple of years ago an MSC article on this issue. The recommendation is as follows. They don't have a problem with you doing a cystoscopy as long as there's some indication. Laparoscopic hysterectomy in and of itself, or TVH in and of itself, is not sufficient indication. That being said, the bar can be very low. You can say, there was one point where I was a little closer to the ureter than I would have liked, and so I decided to do a cystoscopy. But the point that I want to drive home is I don't want you to say in the exam that I do cystoscopy routinely on all these patients. That would not be a good thing. That would be regarded as overly aggressive. Now, some of you may be having cystoscopies on all your cases, provided the number isn't too large. But if you've got four or five, for example, hysterectomies where you did a cystoscopy afterwards, you can say in the exam, you know, in this year of collecting cases, in each of these five cases that I had, there was an issue in each of them that I felt a little concerned, and I wanted to go ahead and do the cystoscopy. But if the hysterectomy is simple, straightforward, and without any complication, I don't think the cystoscopy is necessary. So you can say, you know, and I actually used this exact phrase in my exam for what it's worth. I said, you know, this year was just a bad year for collecting cases as far as this issue was concerned. For me, it was an issue of C-sections I can't even remember, for a certain indication. But you can say this was just a bad year for doing collecting cases for hysterectomy, because each of those patients did justify a cystoscopy. So the bottom line, the bar can be very low, but I don't want you to be seen doing it routinely on all cases. That's the important thing. The intraoperative consult, not a problem. Everything else pretty much seems okay. Let's get to the discussion on no endometrial biopsy. Now, look, if the patient's over 40 or 45, there's no question that a patient with AUB needs an endometrial biopsy. I'm assuming, for the sake of argument, that this patient is, let's say, 38. And the question, does she need a endometrial biopsy? And I can make a strong argument that she does. Because if you're watching her in the office and she subsequently goes on to develop a hyperplasia, she's going to develop increasing and irregular bleeding. And you'll get a chance to address that. But if you're doing a hysterectomy, you don't know what she's got at the moment, at the time of doing surgery. And in the very, admittedly, very unlikely chance that she's harboring a hyperplasia or an adenocarcinoma, even less likely, at the moment, you're taking that small chance. And so if you're going to do a hysterectomy, there's a strong case to be made that even if the patient is somewhat younger, an endometrial biopsy should be done. Now, if you didn't do one, you know, I think the best policy always is to be open and honest. And if there are, and I'm sure there are some of you in the audience who have this kind of a case on your list, it's the best thing to say, you know, this patient should have had an endometrial biopsy. There was a slip up in the preoperative workup, and I should have noticed that. And as a consequence of this case, I now routine on every single case of hysterectomy, I make sure that there's a checkbox that I have to check off. I've instituted this since this case that I have to check off, is an endometrial biopsy necessary, indicated, and B, was it done? So this case, although she had no problems, the histology subsequently was benign, I have to admit we were lucky. There's a very small chance it could have come back problematic. But as a consequence of this case, I've now instituted a change that I really believe this kind of thing won't happen again. And so you're being open and honest. You're explaining, you're taking responsibility. You've shown you understand why it's important. Obviously, you've got to be able to talk just a little bit on endometrial hyperplasia and malignancy. You're showing how you know what is important to do, and you've changed the way you practice. The examiner can't ask for more. So this is the approach. If you feel you've left it off, just by the way, on while we're talking about this, this pretty much exact issue comes up very often, and I'm sure that a few of you in the audience today who have this issue on your cases, you've done an endometrial ablation without first doing an endometrial biopsy or a DNC. Now, if you did the DNC at the time of the ablation, which some of you in this situation may have done, that's not good enough, because the key thing is you have to have a histology report before you can go ahead and do the endometrial ablation, because if she's got hyperplasia of any kind, or malignancy, heaven forbid, then the ablation becomes contraindicated. So you've got to show that you did have a histology report that ruled out hyperplasia or malignancy before you did the endometrial ablation. And doing a DNC and ablation under the same anesthetic won't provide that. So this is another case where you would say, you know, as a consequence of this case, I do things differently. The only other caveat that I would add to this endometrial ablation case is you want to be able to say, okay, the examiner will say, okay, I understand, you know, if you're to manage this case again, you'll do it differently, and that's the wording you should use. If I was to manage this case again, I'd do it a little differently. But if the examiner turns around to you and says, okay, so I understand you did it and it turned out fine, but what would you have done had it not have turned out fine? You've got to be able to address that. And how would you follow up this patient? How would you counsel her? Would you recommend she go for a subsequent hysterectomy? Be prepared for that question, okay? So what I'm going to do, I'm just going to unmute all of us just for a second. And if there are any questions on this, what I've mentioned so far, let me see, open mode. I'll take the question, then we'll carry on with the second case. So if you have a question on anything that I've discussed so far, just mention your first name, and then I'll acknowledge, and then you can pose your question. Anyone? Don't be shy. I hear a lot of
Hello.
Silence. Yes, what's your name? First
Hi.
Name?
This is Nas, and I have a question on global cystoscopy after hysterectomy.
Yes.
And you mentioned that you don't want to do it. And, you know, I know there was a study on it, but I think after this I have to go just look over it a little bit more. But, you know, in training and also now in practice, I do global cystoscopy after hysterectomy. And now that this just concerned me. Oh,
okay. So are you? Let me just ask you a question. Are you saying that? I want to make sure I understand you correctly. Are you saying you acknowledge that they don't want to do it routinely, but in your practice, that in fact, in your hospital, in your practice, that in fact is what is happening? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. And
okay.
All my partners also were doing it, so I kind of got more encouraged in practice to do it.
I'm so pleased you mentioned this. This is such an important issue. And the general principle is relevant for you as well as everyone else. Look, in the brief question that you gave me, you've acknowledged your understanding of what is, I'm being a little harsh when I say standard of care, but what is really recommended nationwide. And you've also acknowledged that that's not what you're doing, because things in your hospital, in your practice, are done a little differently. And this kind of issue, yours is over cystoscopy. It can be over 101 different things. This is common to a lot of people. And the way you handle this is to be blatantly open and honest. You say, because it probably will come up, and you can certainly, if you want, bring it up yourself. You say, you know, I'm going to role play you in the exam, okay? I would say to the examiner, you'll notice I did a cystoscopy on this case, and in fact, if you have a look, it's been my routine to do cystoscopies on all these cases. This has been a bit of an issue for me, because I am aware that the teaching is not to do it routinely, but only if there's some indication, no matter how small. But in my hospital and in my practice, this approach is somewhat frowned upon, and everyone's doing cystoscopies, and I've been put in a very awkward situation, and I'm uncomfortable with it, and it's getting to the point, I'm trying to get them to loosen up on this recommendation, but it's getting to the point that if they don't, I may find that I'm forced to leave the practice because I'm not comfortable to do things that aren't really fully recognized. So how does that approach sound to you, Naz? Would you be comfortable to say that?
Yeah, I would be comfortable. I guess
the key thing is to be open and honest.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, last time I checked, just saying that ACOG says, for high risk, if you're suspecting that something is happening or you might have injured, to do the cystoscopy, but also, like, universal cystoscopy requires further studies.
That's exactly correct. So you can say that. My understanding is that ACOG recommends the following, and you go and repeat exactly what you said. We're actually in total agreement in terms of standard of care. We're both in agreement that routine standard cystoscopy is not warranted. The bar can be very low. The concern can be very minor. And then you've got a justification. But I just don't want you folks in the exam to say, I do it routinely. And if you have been doing it routinely, I've shared now with Naz and the rest of you, how you can present that. Again, be comfortable to say it. It's the truth. You come across with integrity. And the examiner, you're building a relationship with your examiner. It's really very good. I encourage you to do that. I encourage all of you to practice that kind of approach. Actually, practice speaking it out. Okay? So, Naz, are you okay with that?
Yes. Thank you so much.
Sure. So very briefly, is there anyone else who has a question on this case that I've just presented?
Hi.
I don't hear anything. Yes, hi there. What's the first name?
Hi. My name is Jessica. And
Jessica, hi.
Regarding the robot HIST, so it's been kind of our group as a practice that, for the ones who do have the robot privileges and so competent, like, we'll take on a lot of the more complicated cases. So I guess on my list, there are, I don't have any conventional laparoscopy for hysterectomies. They've all been robotically assisted.
This is an issue. It's not a problem, but it is an issue. And I'm sure there are others listening in who've got similar issues in this exact scenario. So you've got to look at numbers. Are we talking about 3 hysterectomies or 13 or 53? Because your approach would differ. But let me just ask you, Jessica, because you are privileged, so to speak, in this area, are you getting cases referred to you for the robotic approach, or are these all your patients that you worked up and landed up being robotic? Do you understand the difference in them? Did you generate them yourselves, or did they include your own cases and referrals to you?
It's a little bit of both. Majority are my cases, but I do have a couple that were referred to me.
Okay. So the ones that are referred to you, the easiest thing is to say, you know, because I'm privileged in this area and because I have a reputation in the area, geographic area, patients, colleagues refer cases to me for this. Whenever I do a case, I will always beforehand evaluate the patient to make sure that the robotic approach is the best approach. And this year of collecting cases, all of them were appropriate. And I went ahead and did them robotically. Of the 12 hysterectomies that I've got, six of them, were my own cases. And of those cases, it turned out that this year, all of them, given my comfort level, I felt the best way was to do a robotic case. In no cases was a vaginal hysterectomy feasible. In all of these cases, they had a contraindication. And so the question was robotic versus laparoscopic versus conventional. And given the individual situations of each case, the one had a lot of adhesions, the one had a history of endometriosis, the other had a history of PID and previous surgery, etc. Given the individual cases and given my personal experience, I felt the best thing was to do a robotic case. But I have to impress upon you, Dr. Examiner, that it is my opinion that the best way to remove a uterus is vaginally. And if everything is optimal up to a size of X, I don't care if it's 6 weeks or 26 weeks, up to a size of X weeks, I will do a case by choice vaginally because I think that's the best approach for the patient. So, Jessica, how does that sound to you as you hear me say it?
Great. I'm just trying to type it all down.
So yeah, you can listen to the archive, by the way. This will all be archived, and you can hear it. So that's the one point. And this conversation will typically continue on as a conversation on the pros and cons of TVH versus laparoscopic, both robotic and non-robotic, versus abdominal hysterectomy. And this is a very, very big, huge subject. So much so, and I'll get a little plug, we know historically that virtually every one of you listening to this teleseminar, you're all going to come to the Definitive Board prep course, be it live or in person, online, Los Angeles, Baltimore, wherever. We're going to spend 20 minutes, 30 minutes just showing you how to handle this conversation. That's how important it is. Every single one of you, no matter what kind of hysterectomy you're doing, you need to be comfortable to handle this conversation. So we've got you covered. I don't want you to worry about that. But just know we will go into more detail, and I've given you the tip of the iceberg right now. So you're okay with that, Jessica, yes?
Yeah, thank you so much.
Sure, no problem. All righty. If there's a quick question, another question, I'll take it. Otherwise, I'm going to move on to the second case. Anyone else? By the way, I appreciate very much the absence of background noise. It really helps everyone tremendously. Okay, I'm going to mute everyone now again. I'm going to go now and move on to the second case, and I'm just going to read it out again and then discuss the issues. So this was presented to us last week by Erin, and she writes as follows, and I'm just reading what she wrote in her email. I have a GYN patient who I recommended should do a short course of GnRH therapy pre-op prior to hysterectomy for large leiomyoma. A few days before her surgery, I found out patient's insurance declined the medication, and she never reached out to ask about authorization or alternatives. I wanted to delay the surgery to do the standard pre-op measure. However, the patient's insurance was going to expire, and she wanted to proceed with the surgery. My question is, how do I make it clear I had an intended plan for pre-op GnRH therapy, but cost and insurance was a factor? I want it to appear I had these thoughts and pre-op planning without too many pre-op planning, without too many words and confusion of her case. So this is it's actually a little similar to the previous case, but has a few subtle differences. The first point I want to make is to say and this is relevant to everyone, obviously, in this case. As a general principle, try to stay away from insurance and financial issues. But this is a case where it's actually impossible because it's a direct consequence of insurance and financial matters that this patient didn't receive what we would regard as the optimal therapy. It's not that she got suboptimal treatment. We don't know what her pre-op hemoglobin was, because depo-leuprin would have raised the hemoglobin by stopping periods. We also don't know how big the uterus was. So we don't know if it would have likely shrank the uterus to a size which could have been done, if not abdominally, now laparoscopically, or if not laparoscopically, now vaginally. We don't know those sizes, but I'm assuming it would have made a difference. So the question becomes, how do you share with the examiner that you really wanted to do it, but through circumstances beyond your control, you couldn't? And perhaps Erin is thinking, maybe I should have declined the surgery because she's being forced. The examiner could make an argument. So you're willing to let a patient dictate you the management that she gets by virtue of her personal circumstances. And the examiner would be correct in posing that question, but the answer should not embarrass anyone. I would say this if the examiner were to go down that road with me. I would say, you know, given the size, given the symptoms, given the hemoglobin, I do think preoperative depo-leupron would have been a benefit, and they would have been A, B, C, D, E. But when I realized what the patient's circumstances were, I felt to not do the surgery and let this patient get into a situation where her personal situation would be far worse, no insurance, far greater difficulty in getting the necessary care that was appropriate for her, at least the hysterectomy. I felt the better thing to do, the better of two suboptimal options, was to go ahead and do the hysterectomy. So be open and be honest. That's, you know, when you come to our course, you'll hear me say this over and over again. Be open and honest. You folks are making, you know, if any of you, besides Erin, if she's listening in, if any of you had a case like this, I guarantee you would have managed it exactly the same. So don't be shy about sharing your decision-making with the examiner and just explain very clearly without going, you know, into a huge essay, but just explain verbally very clearly what happened. And you say, given the entirety of the patient's situation, and I felt it was better to go ahead and do whatever hysterectomy was needed without depo-leupron than to run the risk that her hysterectomy might be delayed by 6, 12, 24 months and could cause significant morbidity in the interim. It was a judgment call. I think it was a fair call. And I've got to be honest, if I was presented with this kind of case again, I think I would do the same thing. But by saying that, you're showing confidence and comfortness with your decision. So that's how I would handle this. And this is an example of Depo-Lupron. It can be for anything, OB and GYN especially. Office not so commonly, but it does happen. You've got to take into account the patient's entirety in deciding. And also, just be aware, if you turn around to the patient and say, I can't help you, after you've started down the road, you've got to be very, very careful, because you're going to potentially get into a conversation on medical ethics, because the examiner could argue with you. In this case, I think it's totally defensible. But the examiner might start the conversation, was what you did ethical? Because isn't this tantamount, if you would not have done the surgery, isn't this tantamount to patient abandonment, which is a no-no and speaks to patient autonomy? So, you know, when is autonomy absolute and when is it not? And there is a gray zone. This case is in that gray zone. But I think if you just be totally open and honest, you're going to have no problems whatsoever. So with that being said, I'm going to unmute everyone again. And if you've got any questions, if you have any questions about this or something similar, again, please just shout out your name and I'll acknowledge, and then we can have the conversation. So I throw it open to you folks. Come on, folks, don't be shy. Because if there's no conversation, we're done for the day. Is there even if we have a question somewhat unrelated to the two cases that we presented now? We're all good. I don't hear anything. I just hear silence. Going once?
Hi.
Going twice?
This
yes,
is
hi there.
Again.
What's the name? Who's this?
Nas.
Nas. Hi there, Nas. Thank you. Go ahead.
Yes.
Yeah.
So this is not related with regard to this case. This is a case I have. If we have time, is that okay if we discuss that?
No. This is these are the two cases that I had. So go ahead. Let's talk about your concern.
Yeah. Okay. So I had a patient refer to me with heavy menstrual bleeding. She was nulliparous with a BMI of 50, and so I did the workup for heavy menstrual bleeding or AUB, did an EMB, came back as acute endometritis, and the pathology report was also sounding really unusual to me. So I did call the pathologist, and we talked through it. So
can I just interrupt you for one second, Nas? Nas, one question. What was it in the histology report that was unusual to you? You mentioned there was a raging endometritis.
So it said acute endometritis, a lot of neutrophils, a lot of inflammatory markers, and I was just like, I've never seen that. You know, I've seen...
Okay, but understand, think about it. If you've got an acute infection, inflammation, you're going to expect a lot of neutrophils, PMNs, and probably lymphocytes as well. So it's not that surprising. The reason why I'm bringing this up, you don't want to be overly cautious, because you don't want to give the examiner the idea that you may not appreciate, and I'm not don't mean to be knocking you, Nas. You don't want them to think that you don't realize that an acute inflammatory process is associated with PMNs and occasionally lymphocytes. That's the point.
I see.
So you can say, look, it was the wording was for a it seems like an extreme endometritis. And I just wanted to get further input from the pathologist. But don't say it was odd, because at the end of the day, it's not odd. It actually fits very well. Okay?
Yeah, yeah. But there was, I don't have the actual pathology, but so in the comments, they mentioned a lot of things that I've never, like, you know, the neutrophils was part of it, but there were a lot of other the wording that I wasn't, you know, comfortable
with. So let me caution you, Naz, as well as everyone listening in. As OBGYNs, yes. Our pet hate subject is histopathology, correct? I'm sure you loathe having a conversation. Just understand, by bringing this conversation up, you're digging deeper into a histology conversation, which may not be the way you want to go. But let's have a conversation now, and then you can decide how you want to handle it in the exam. So go ahead, carry on.
Okay. So, I mean, anyways, I sent the pathology report, forwarded to the gyn-onc I usually work with, and also I called the pathologist myself, saying, is this the final read on this path?
And I got to interrupt you for a second. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yeah.
I would not say in the exam, you called gyn-onc. Because number one, you don't have to say that. It's optional. You don't have to. And the reason why I'm bringing this up is, it's my opinion, if all there is inflammatory cells and there are no atypical cells, then I would say it's an overkill. So I would tend to back off on that. But go ahead. Carry on.
Okay. Yeah, I guess like this gyn-onc is mostly like kind of a mentor to me too. So I was just asking him. But
no,
look,
I've got. I'm so pleased you're bringing this up, Naz, because it's good for you and everyone listening in. It's good to show respect for seniority, and I would never ever knock that. But here you've got a case where on the report there's. Based on what you've told me thus far, there's nothing to suggest malignancy. And they could argue that you're overutilizing your resources. And by overutilizing the gyn-onc, if you ramp it up, you're taking away his or her time to deal with real oncology matters as they deal with you. So, again, based on what you've said so far, I would not mention gyn-onc. But for the purpose of our conversation, carry on. Go ahead. Yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead.
The pathologist also mentioned this is the final read. She has acute endometritis. So I did treat her for that. And at the end of the day, she said she wanted a hysterectomy because she was also trans as well. You know, based on the EMB after the treatment, finally she got the hysterectomy in November. And
you've
got
to be very clear. Now, I have to interrupt you. This is really important.
Yes.
And there's nothing wrong with what you're saying, but it's a principle that is important for every one of you on every one of your cases. You've now introduced two reasons to remove a uterus. There's the AUB, and there's the fact that this patient is identifying as a trans and wants a hysterectomy. The question is, what was the primary reason why you did the hysterectomy?
It was for AUB.
Okay. And if it's for AUB, you see, you are going to get caught out either way. But the folks, this is so, Naz, I'm so glad you brought this up. It's important for all of you. If you would have said it was because she was trans, okay? Then you've got to do the workup for a trans to make sure she's got the full workup, psychological, medical, etc. If you're doing it for AUB, you've got to do the full AUB workup. And what you did not mention, you've done it, But you did not mention that after you gave her, I presume, antibiotics for the endometritis, you didn't mention if the AUB continued or if it stopped.
It
you understand?
So, I mean, meanwhile, we've tried other things as well.
So there were failed multiple attempts at conservative management. That's what I was listening out for. But you need to say it. It's so important for you, Nazan, every single one listening in. Okay, I'm interrupting you all the time. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, carry on. That's good. So then the final pathology came back as endometrial cancer, fibrograde 1.
Okay. It flies in the face of all my arguing. But the truth is, it's irrelevant because...
Yeah.
Managing the patient prospectively, you had no indication, would you agree?
Yeah, I didn't.
And this happens, especially in the field of hyperplasia. Sorry?
Yeah, no indication to suspect hyperplasia or fibroblast.
Correct.
Right?
It does happen. Yeah, it's well known to happen. So what did you do? You got this started. So this is a great case, by the way. And I would say probably 10% of people, 10-20% of candidates have something similar to this, where either an endometrial biopsy or a histology report was over or under called when it comes to endometrial hyperplasia or cancer. It's not uncommon. So, and the question is, okay, it happens. And you've got to be comfortable to say, you know, if I was to manage this patient prospectively, again, I will do exactly the same thing. So again, it's a powerful statement. But then the exam will say, okay, fine. I agree with you. Your management was exactly correct, prospectively.
But
now you got this histology report. What did you do?
So, you know, told the patient, referred to the gynonc, you know, talked to the gynonc, and he wanted a referral, sit down, talk about management. And then she started her cancer surveillance, and she wanted to have it with me as a generalist. So the gynonc said that is totally fine. So we did, I think, one surveillance, and she still was having pelvic pain. So I ordered a CT scan, talked to the gynonc also, and I ordered a CT scan, and then she didn't get this done. So the hysterectomy was done around November, mid-November, and then she didn't get this CT done until a month after it was ordered. And on the CT, we found 16-centimeter, kind of, they called it pelvic fluid collection versus adnexal mass. She also reported having fever at that time with chills. So I sent her to the hospital, suspecting that this is the pelvic abscess because of the, leukocytosis, all that. But also she's at the risk of, you know, cancer. So so gynonc was also on board. When she was in the hospital, she got an MRI, which based on that read, gynonc just suspected adnexal mass. She didn't want to stay, so all the antibiotic was stopped. She went home with a plan for, diagnostic laparoscopy and all the good stuff by gynonc the next week, like 4 days after she went home.
Mm-hmm.
On the day
just by the way, surgery, they're not going to give you this much time to present the case. You've got to practice speeding it up. But go ahead,
So on the day of surgery, she has a heart attack and she dies at home. So there is no, they didn't do any autopsy, so we have no idea what was the cause.
Do you have in the complications column of the hysterectomy death?
So that's what I'm asking. So
yeah.
I wanted to put it, but my partners are like, well, it wasn't part of, you know, it was like 4 or 5 months after.
I would love you to be bold and comfortable. And I would write down in the complicated, and folks, all of you listening in, this is a very specific case, but the principle is relevant for every single person taking the exam. I would write in the complications column, delayed post-op demise, with an exclamation mark. Because the examiner will ask you what – they have to ask you what happened. How can they just ignore it? And then you get your conversation. But just the only thing is understand what conversation you're going to get. It's going to be a conversation which will include the causes of immediate as well as delayed post-operative death. So it includes such things as DVT, PE, is any bleeding diathesis. I can't think on the G on the OB side. I would include amniotic fluid embolus there. But be comfortable to have that conversation. But the principle here, this is for you, Naz, as well as everyone listening in. Put it in, and then be prepared and comfortable to talk about it, because there's no ways the examiner is going to ask you, going to ignore it, and it's just at the end of the day, no, there was, if you were to manage this patient differently again, knowing that she was heading for a death, if you had the same patient with the same presentation, and you're managing her anti-grade as it goes in real time, would you manage her any differently from this patient that you just had?
I mean, not really, but...
There's your answer.
I don't know.
There's no buts.
I mean,
you would do exactly the same thing. Yeah, no. But you didn't. Yeah, it would have been nice. And also, just by the way, it's probably not inappropriate to speculate what you think the autopsy may have found. That's a legitimate question, even though you'll never know and the examiner will never know. Yeah, I would have guessed it would have been ABC, but we'll never know. How old was the patient, by the way?
She was very young. She was 43.
Wow, that's very tragic.
Yeah.
Be prepared to talk about obesity surgery in obese patients. Okay, entry into the abdomen, how you close the abdominal wall, pros and cons of different approaches, etc. That can also go down that road with you. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, Naz, you're comfortable with that?
Yeah, but also talking about pathology, I'll bring out the pathology report and send it to you.
With pleasure. I'll be happy. Just put your telephone number so I can call you back and your time zone, and we can discuss it.
But I called back.
And just by the way, I know now why you were calling why you wanted to tell me that you called the gyn onc, but managing prospectively, that was not correct. It was overutilization of resources.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, I agree.
Listen,
but,
very nice.
You know, it's
very
funny
nice.
The pathologist called me. The same pathologist read the FIGO grade 1. And
yeah.
Then, she was like, actually, we went back on that slide, and we could have read it as FIGO grade 1. And then,
no, hold on. No, it was read out as FIGO grade 1. She went back and said it could have been read as what?
So she went back to the EMB path.
Oh, the EMB, and that could have been FIGO stage 1 as well.
Yes. I was like,
okay.
Well...
Okay, so look, let me tell you. And this is classical. And I, at the definitive board prep course, I'm going to give you folks a one-hour lecture on histology. And about 15 minutes of that lecture is going to revolve around endometrial hyperplasia, malignancy, and how sometimes it can be very difficult for the pathologist to distinguish between what we used to call complex hyperplasia with atypia, today we'd call it EIN, to distinguish between that and early cancer. And that is your exact case. It's we've got you covered, folks. You'll be very comfortable with this issue once you've sat in on that histology lecture. In fact, you won't fear histology so much. But this is a great case, and it happens. This kind of stuff happens. Don't feel bad. It's a great case, Niles. You'll do great. Okay?
Thank you.
All right. Folks, listen, I hope you found that very helpful. Just a quick announcement before we go, because we did run over time. I really like to keep these to about 45 minutes, but we had some really interesting cases, so it was well worthwhile. I hope you found it helpful. This was a makeup, a makeup teleseminar. Normally we do them every 2 weeks, but because I'm out of phase now, we go back to being in phase. So the next teleseminar will not be in 2 weeks' time. It'll be in 1 week's time. So the next one will be on the 7th of May, which is today, 1 week, and we'll do this all again then. So to Nas, as well as William and Aaron, who weren't here, but they can pick this up on archive, but Nas, who volunteered, thank you so much. And we will do this again next week. So if you have any questions, feel free to get in touch, info@examfra.com. I hope you found this helpful. We'll see you again next week. Thank you so much. Take care, folks. Bye-bye.